Disc 5.
Looking like a parenthesis, Talatbek Rabbani sat on a high stool, hunched over a high desk, a thick cigarette dangling from his bone-dry lips, a smog of smoke hovering over his bald head like a rain cloud. An old man who must have been nudging 90, he was not much thicker than the pencil clasped in his arthritic fingers. A tuft of coarse white hair protruded from under his lower lip and served as a receptacle for the ash that dropped off the burning end of the cigarette. A swell of warm air enveloped Martin as he stepped into the room. The old man kept his office heated to near sauna temperatures. Settling onto a tattered settee with the tag "Imported from Sri Lanka" still attached to one spindly wooden leg, Martin could hear the water gurgling through the radiators. "Talatbek Rabbani sounds like a Tajik name," he remarked. "If I had to take a wild guess, I'd say you were a Tajik from the steppes of the Panjshir Valley, north of Kabul. I seem to remember there was a tribal chief named Rabbani who presided over a cluster of mountain villages near the frontier with Uzbekistan." Rabbani waved his skeletal fingers to dispel the cigarette smoke and get a better look at his visitor.
"You have been to Afghanistan?" he demanded.
"In a previous incarnation, I hung out for the better part of a year near the Khyber Pass." Rabbani was still trying to get a handle on Martin's curriculum vitae.
"What were you doing, my son? Buying or selling?"
"Buying. Stories. I was debriefing fighters going into and out of Afghanistan and writing them up for a wire service." An ephemeral smile crossed Rabbani's age-ravaged eyes.
"Wire service, my eye. Only people who hung out at the Khyber Pass were American intelligence agents, which means you are on the same side as my older brother, the tribal chieftain, Rabbani."
Martin had guessed as much once he'd placed Rabbani's name. He hoped that this would get him off on the right track with the old codger, who, he now noticed, kept his left hand out of sight below the desk. His fingers were certainly wrapped around the butt end of a pistol. "What happened to your brother after the Russians were kicked out?"
"Along with everyone else in the valley, he got caught up in the civil war. He fought alongside Ahmed Shah Massoud against the Taliban when they abandoned their madrasas in Pakistan and started to infiltrate into Afghanistan. One day the Taliban invited my brother to meet under a white flag in the outskirts of Kabul."
The same smile appeared in Rabbani's eyes, only this time it was tainted with bitterness.
"I advised him against going, but he was strong-headed and fearless and shrugged off my counsel. And so he went. And so the Taliban cut his throat, along with those of his three bodyguards."
"I vaguely remember the incident." Rabbani's left hand came into view, which told Martin that he had passed muster.
"To have been at the Khyber, to remember Rabbani," the old man said, "you must have worked for the CIA.
When Martin neither confirmed nor denied it, Rabbani nodded slowly.
"I understand there are things that are never spoken aloud. You must forgive an old man for his lack of discretion."
Martin could hear trains pulling into or out of the station next to the warehouse with the rhythmic throb that was almost as satisfying as travel itself. "If you don't mind my asking, Mr. Rabbani, how did you wind up in London?"
"I was dispatched by my brother to England to purchase medical supplies for our wounded fighters. When my brother was murdered, a cousin on my mother's side profited from my absence to usurp the leadership of the tribe. My cousin and I are sworn enemies. Tribal custom prevents me from exposing to you the reason for this feud, while there is no representative of my cousin present to defend the other side of the matter. Suffice it to say that it became healthier for me to stay on in London."
"And you went into the business of selling prostheses with Samat?"
"I don't know how well you know Samat," Rabbani said, "but he is a philanthropist at heart. He provided the startup money to lease this warehouse and open the business."
"The Samat I know does not have a reputation as a philanthropist," Martin said flatly. "He wheels and deals in many of the weapons that lead to the loss of limbs. If he is in the business of selling false limbs to war-torn countries, there must be a healthy profit in it."
"You misread Samat, my son," Rabbani insisted. "And you misread me. Samat is too young to be interested only in profit, and I am too old. The cartons filled with false limbs that you saw on the way to my office are sold at cost."
"Uh-huh."
"You clearly do not believe me."
Rabbani slipped awkwardly off the high stool, and, retrieving two wooden canes that had been out of sight behind the desk, made his way across the room. When he stood before the settee, he hiked the trouser on his left leg, revealing a skin-colored plastic prosthesis with a Gucci loafer fitted onto the end of it. Martin asked quietly, "How did you lose your leg?"
"I was told it was a landmine."
"Don't you remember?"
"Some nights fleeting images of what happened surface in my brain. A deafening explosion, the taste of dirt in my mouth, the stickiness of my stump when I reached down to touch it, the feeling I had for months that the leg was still there and I could feel pain in it. The images seem to come from the life of another, and so I have trouble reconstructing the event."
"Psychiatrists call that a survival mechanism, I think." Leaning on one cane and then the other, Rabbani returned to his high chair and hefted himself into it.
"I first met Samat when I was buying Soviet surplus arms and munitions in Moscow in the early 90s, so that Massoud and my brother could defend the Panjshir. The Russian army units pulling out of their bases in the former German Democratic Republic after the Berlin Wall came down were selling off everything in their arsenals. Rifles, machine guns, mortars, landmines, radios, jeeps, tanks, ammunition. Samat, representing the business interests of someone very powerful, was the middleman. It was a period of my life when I felt no guilt about buying and using these arms. I did to the Taliban what they eventually did to me. That was before I myself walked on a landmine. Take it from someone who has been there, Mr. Oldham. It's an exhilarating experience, stepping on a mine. One instant you are attached to the ground, the next you are defying gravity, flailing away in the air. When you fall back to earth, you have one limb less, and nothing, not your body, not your mind, is ever the same. It was Samat who arranged for me to be flown to a Moscow hospital. It was Samat who came around with my manufactured in America artificial leg. It would not be an exaggeration to say that I became another person, which is why you find me presiding over a warehouse filled with prostheses that we sell at cost.
And where does the name Soft Shoulder come from?
Samat and I were traveling in the U.S. once, Rabbani explained. We were driving a large American automobile from Santa Fe in New Mexico to New York when we stumbled across the idea of going into the business of exporting artificial limbs at prices that would make them more easily affordable to the victims of war. We had pulled up at the side of the road to urinate when we shook hands on the project. Next to the car was a sign that read, "Soft Shoulder." Neither of us knew what it meant, but we decided it would make a fitting name for our company.
The intercom buzzed. Rabbani depressed a lever with a deft jab of a cane and barked irritably,
"And what is it now, my girl?"
Mrs. Rainfield's voice came over the speaker.
"Trucks here for the Bosnia shipment, Mr. Rabbani. I sent them round back to the loading dock. They gave me a certified bank check for the correct amount." "Call the bank to confirm it issued the check. Meanwhile, get Rashid to supervise the loading."
Rabbani tripped the lever closed with his cane, cutting the connection.
"Can't be too vigilant," he moaned. "Lot of shady dealers make a lot of money peddling prostheses. They're not happy when someone else sells them at cost."
He pried the stub of the cigarette out of his mouth and lobbed it across the room into a metal wastebasket.
"When were you in Israel, Mr. Odom?"
"Went there roughly 10 days back."
"You told Mrs. Rainfield to tell me you knew Samat from Israel. Why did you lie?"
Martin understood that a lot depended on how he answered the question. "In order to get past the front door," he said. He angled his head. "What makes you think I was lying?" Rabbani pulled an enormous handkerchief from a pocket and wiped the perspiration under his shirt collar at the back of his neck.
"Samat left Israel before you got there, my son."
"How do you know that?" The old man shrugged his bony shoulders.
"I will not ask you how you know what you know. Do me the courtesy of not asking me how I know what I know. Samat fled from Israel. If you came knocking at my door today, it is because you somehow found a record of his phone conversations and traced the calls he made to this address in London, despite the fact that these phone records were supposed to have been destroyed. I will not ask you how you did that. The phone company is not permitted to reveal addresses corresponding to unlisted numbers."
"Why did you let me in if you knew I was lying about Samat?"
"I calculated if you were clever enough to find me, you might be clever enough to lead me to Samat."
"Join the queue, Mr. Rabbani. It seems as if everyone I meet wants to find Samat."
"They want to find Samat in order to kill him. I want to find him in order to save his life."
Do you know why he fled Israel?
Certainly I know. He fled from Israel for the same reason he fled to Israel. Chechen hitmen were after him. Have been since the great mob wars in Moscow. Samat works for the oligarch. You are smart, I'll give you that, but not so smart that you've heard of him.
Martin couldn't resist. Samat's uncle, Tsvetan Ugorzhilov. The old man cackled until the laugh turned into a grating cough. Saliva trickled from a corner of his mouth. He dabbed at it with a handkerchief as he gasped for breath.
You are a smart one. Do you know what happened during the Great Mob War?
The Slavic alliance battled the Chechen gangs, over territory, over who controlled what.
At the height of the war, the Chechens had about 500 fighters working out of the Rossiya Hotel not far from the Kremlin. The leader of the Chechens was known by his nom de guerre, which was the Ottoman. The oligarch arranged to have him and his lady friend at the time kidnapped. Samat was sent to negotiate with the Chechens. If they wanted their leader back, they would have to abandon Moscow and settle for some of the smaller cities that the oligarch was willing to cede them. The Chechens said they needed to discuss the matter with the others. Samat decided they were playing for time. Even if they agreed, there was no guarantee they would give up Moscow. He persuaded the oligarch that the Chechens needed to be taught a lesson. Next morning, people going to work found the body of the Ottoman and his lady friend hanging upside down from a lamppost near the Kremlin wall. Newspapers compared it to the death of Mussolini and his mistress in the closing days of the Great Patriotic War.
And you call Samat a philanthropist?
We all of us have many sides, my son. That was one side of Samat. The other was selling prosthesis at cost to provide limbs to landmine victims. I was one person before I stepped on the landmine and another after. What about you, Mr. Odom? Are you one-dimensional, or do you have multiple personalities like the rest of us?
Martin brought a hand up to his forehead to contain the migraine throbbing like the trains pulling into and out of the station. Across the room, the old man carefully pulled another cigarette from a desk drawer and lit it with a wooden match, which he ignited with a flick of his fingernail. Once again, the smog of a rain cloud rose over his head.
Who is paying you to find Samat, Mr. Odom?
Martin explained about the wife Samat had abandoned in Israel, how she needed to find her husband so he could grant her a religious divorce in front of a rabbinical court. Puffing away on his cigarette, Rabbani thought about this.
Not like Samat to abandon a wife like that, he decided. If he ran for it, it means the Chechens tracked him to that Jew colony next to Hebron. Chechens have long knives and long memories. I've been told some of them carry photographs cut from the newspapers of the Ottoman and his lady hanging upside down from a Moscow lamppost. The Chechens must have been knocking on Samat's door, figuratively speaking, for him to cut and run.
Rabbani hauled open another drawer and retrieved a metal box, which he opened with a key attached to the fob of the gold watch in his vest pocket. He took out a wad of English banknotes and dropped them on the edge of the desk nearest Martin.
I would like to find Samat before the Chechens catch up with him. I would like to help him. He does not need money. He has access to all the money he could ever want. But he does need friends. I could arrange for him to disappear into a new identity, into a new life even. So will you work for me, Mr. Odom? Will you find Samat and tell him that Talatbek Rabbani stands ready to come to the assistance of his friend?
If Samat is being hunted by the Chechens, helping him could come back to haunt you. Rabbani reached for one of the canes and tapped it against his false limb.
I owe Samat my leg, and my leg has become my life. A Tajik never turns his back on such a debt, my son.
Martin pushed himself to his feet and walked over to the desk and fanned the stack of banknotes as if it were a deck of cards. Then he collected them and shoved them into a pocket. I hope you are going to tell me where to start to look. The old man picked up the pencil, scratched something on the back of an envelope, and handed it to Martin.
Samat came here after he left Israel. He wanted to touch base with the projects to which he was especially attached. He stayed 2 days, then took a plane to Prague. There is an affiliate in Prague, another one of Samat's pet projects, that's doing secret work for him on the side. I met one of the directors, a Czech woman, when she came here to see Samat. She gave me her card in case I ever visited Prague.
What kind of secret work?
Not sure I overheard the woman talking with Samat. The project had something to do with trading the bones of a Lithuanian saint for sacred Jewish Torah scrolls. Don't ask what the bones of a saint have to do with Torah scrolls. I don't know. Samat was very compartmented. The Samat I knew exported prosthesis at cost. There were other Samats that I only caught glimpses of. One of them was concocting a scheme at the address I gave you in Prague. Martin glanced at the paper, then held out a hand. Rabbani's bony fingers, soft with paraffin-colored skin, gripped his as if he didn't want him to leave. Words barely recognizable as human speech bubbled up from the old man's larynx.
I see things from the perspective of someone who is knocking at death's door. Apocalypse is just around the corner, my son. You are looking at me as if I belong in an asylum, Mr. Odom. I am in an asylum. So, come to think of it, are you? Western civilization, or what is left of it, is one big asylum. The happy few who understand this are diagnosed as crazy and hidden away in lunatic bins.
Rabbani struggled for breath.
Find Samat before they do, he gasped. He is one of the happy few.
I'll do my best, Martin promised. Making his way back through the aisles toward the front of the warehouse, Martin passed three lean men wrestling cartons onto a dolly. Rabbani's bodyguard, Rashid, stood apart, watching them with his unblinking eyes. The three men, all clean-shaven, were dressed alike in orange jumpsuits with the insignia of a shipping company sewn over the zipper of the breast pocket. As Martin walked past, they raised their eyes to scrutinize him. None of them smiled. There was something about them in that troubled Martin, but he couldn't put his finger on it. Mrs. Rainfield waved from her cubicle as he headed down the cement corridor toward the front door. As he reached it, a discreet crackle of electric current sizzled through the lock and the door clicked open. Out in the street, Martin waved cheerfully at the security camera over his head. He was still trying to figure out what it was about the three shippers that had caught his eye as he started up the street in the direction of Golders Green and the rooming house. The three men in orange jumpsuits piled the cartons so high on the dolly that the topmost one began to teeter. Rashid jumped forward to keep it from falling to the ground.
"Watch what you are doing," he started to say.
He turned back to find himself staring into the bore of a silencer screwed into the barrel of an Italian Beretta. It was aimed directly at his forehead. Rashid nodded imperceptibly, a Muslim authorizing the assassin to end his life. The man in the orange jumpsuit nodded back, acknowledging that Rashid was the master of his destiny, and squeezed the trigger. There was a muted hiss from the handgun, which recoiled slightly as a neat puncture wound materialized in Rashid's forehead. The second man caught him under the armpits and lowered the body to the cement floor. The third man crossed the warehouse to Mrs. Rainfield's office and rapped his knuckles on the glass door. She motioned for him to come in.
"What can I do you, dear?" she asked.
He produced a silenced pistol from the zippered pocket of his jumpsuit and shot her through the heart.
"Die," he replied as she slumped onto the desk, her lifeless eyes frozen open in bewilderment. Back in the warehouse, the two other men knocked on the door of Talatbek Rabbani's office and entered. One of them held out the manifest.
"Mr. Rabbani, there are two cartons of size 6 foot prostheses missing," one of them said as they approached his desk.
"That is absolutely impossible," Talatbek Rabbani said,
snatching up his canes and pushing himself to his feet.
"Did you ask Rashid?"
He became aware of the handgun fitted with a silencer inches from his skull.
"Who are you?"
he whispered harshly.
"Who sent you?"
"We are who we are," the man with the gun responded.
He wrenched the canes out of Talatbek's hands and, grabbing him by the wrists, dragged him across the warehouse, a Gucci loafer trailing at the end of the plastic prosthesis, to a stanchion near the body of Rashid. The man who had shot Mrs. Rainfield brought over a spool of thick orange packing cord and tied the old man's wrists. Then he lobbed the spool over an overhead pipe and pulled on the cord until Talatbek's arms, stretched directly above his head, were straining in their shoulder sockets, and the toe of his good foot was scraping the cement. The man who appeared to be the leader of the team approached the old man.
"Where is Samat?"
Talatbek shook his head.
"How is it possible to tell you something I myself do not know?"
"You will forfeit your life if you refuse to help us find him."
"When you arrive in hell, I will be waiting for you, my son."
"Are you a Muslim?" the leader inquired. Talatbek managed to nod. "Do you believe in the Creator, the Almighty? Do you believe in Allah?"
Talatbek indicated he did.
"Have you made pilgrimage to Mecca?" Rabbani, his face contorted with pain, nodded again. "Say your prayers, then. You are about to meet the one true God."
The old man shut his eyes and murmured,
"Ashhadu an la ilahu illallah, wa ashhadu anna Muhammadan Rasulullah."
From the inside of his boot, the leader of the team of killers drew a razor-sharp dagger with a groove along its thin blade and a yellowing camel bone handle. He stepped to one side of the old man and probed the soft wrinkles of skin on his thin neck, looking for a vein.
"For the last time, where is Samat?"
"Samat who?"
The leader found the vein and slowly embedded the blade into Talatbek's neck until only the hilt remained visible. Blood spurted, staining the killer's orange jumpsuit before he could leap out of the way. The old man breathed in liquidy gasps, each shallower than the previous one, until his head plunged forward and his weight sagged under the cord, pulling his arms out of the shoulder sockets. Martin dialed Stella's number in Crown Heights from the booth and listened to the phone ringing on the other end. It dawned on him that he was looking forward to hearing her voice. There was no denying that she had gotten under his skin. "That really you, Martin?" she exclaimed before he could finish a sentence. "God damn, I'm glad to hear from you. Missed you, believe it or not."
"Missed you, too," he said, before he knew what he would say. In the strained silence, he imagined her tongue flicking over the chip in her front tooth. She cleared her throat.
"What do you say we get the business part of the conversation out of the way first? Yes, there was an autopsy. For obvious reasons, it was done by a CIA doctor. The FBI man who Dad dealt with when he needed something sent it to me, along with a covering letter. In it, he said the police found no evidence of a break-in. The doctor who performed the autopsy concluded that Dad had died of a heart attack."
Martin was thinking out loud. "Maybe you should get a second opinion."
"Too late for another autopsy."
"What does that mean, too late?"
"When nobody claimed Kastner's body, the CIA had him cremated. All they gave me was his ashes. I walked halfway across the Brooklyn Bridge and screamed out the punchline from one of those old anti-Soviet jokes that Kastner particularly liked. Be careful what you struggle for, because you may get it," and scattered the ashes in the river.
"Uh-huh."
"I hate it when you say uh-huh, because I'm never sure what you mean by it."
"I didn't mean anything. I'm just buying time for my brain to work things out."
"Did you get to talk to Singh in the Chinese restaurant?"
"Yes, he was very suspicious until I convinced him I was a friend of yours. He was annoyed you hadn't come back for the funeral of the Chinese girl your bees killed."
"What did you tell him?"
"I said you were busy detecting, and he seemed to settle for that. The girl..."
"Her name was Min."
"Min died in great pain, Martin. The police who investigated it decided her death was an accident."
Martin offered up a short laugh. "The honey exploded by accident."
"What does that mean?"
"Nothing.
Did you find out what she was wearing when the bees attacked her?"
"The Daily News story said she was wearing a white jumpsuit with the sleeves and legs rolled up. A pith helmet with mosquito netting attached to it was found near her body."
A police cruiser with a screaming siren tore past Martin, drowning out all conversation. When it quieted down, Martin could hear Stella saying,
"Oh, I see."
"What do you see?"
"The rolled-up sleeves and legs. It was your jumpsuit, wasn't it? Do you think... could it be that someone..."
"Oh, dear."
Stella lowered her voice.
"I'm frightened, Martin."
"Me too. I'm frightened. Seems as if I'm always frightened."
"Did your trip work out for you?"
"Don't know yet."
"Are you coming back?"
"Not right now."
"Want me to fly over and meet up with you? Two heads are better than one, remember. Two hearts also."
He could almost hear the slight gasp of embarrassment.
"No strings attached, Martin. It goes without saying."
"Why do things that go without saying get said?"
"To avoid confusion. Hey, you want to hear a good Russian joke?"
"Save it for when we meet again."
"I'll settle for that."
"For what?"
She said it very quietly.
"For our meeting again."
Another police car could be heard coming down Golders Green, its siren wailing. Martin said quickly, "Bye."
"Yeah, bye. Take care of yourself."
"Uh-huh."
The police car was almost abreast of Martin, and Stella had to shout to be heard.
"There you go again."
Martin found a pub at the top of Golders Green and slid into a booth at the back. The waitress, a skinny young thing with one ear and one nostril and one eyebrow pierced and her navel visible below her short T-shirt, came around with a menu printed in chalk on a small blackboard. Martin ordered the special of the day and a half pint of lager. He was sipping the lager and waiting for the special when there was a commotion in front of the pub. People abandoned the bar and their tables to gather under the television on an overhead shelf. The screen was not facing the back of the pub, so Martin couldn't make out what was being said. When the waitress came around with the pot pie and chips, he asked her what was happening.
"People have been murdered in a warehouse stone's throw from here. Most exciting thing that's happened on Golders Green in a month of Sundays, don't you know? That's what all them police sirens was about."
Martin went around to the front of the pub and caught the end of the news item.
A warehouse, located immediately behind the train station, was the grisly scene of the multiple murders, the male anchor said. According to municipal records, the warehouse was being used as a depot for prostheses being shipped by a humanitarian group called Soft Shoulder to war-ravaged countries.
The female anchor chimed in.
We are now being told that three bodies were removed from the warehouse. They were identified as a Mr. Talatbek Rabbani, aged 88, an Afghan refugee who directed the humanitarian operation and who bled to death from a knife wound to his neck while tied to an overhead pipe. His associate, an Egyptian known only as Rashid, who was killed by a single shot to the head, and his secretary, Mrs. Doris Rainfield, who was also shot to death. A fourth woman is missing, and police fear she may have been kidnapped by the team of hitmen when they fled the scene of the crime. She was identified as Mrs. Froth, and was said to be the wife of the well-known snooker player Nigel Froth.
Returning to his table, Martin found he'd lost all appetite for the pot pie. He raised a finger and caught the waitress's eye and called, "Whiskey, neat. Make that a double." He was nursing the whiskey and his bruised emotions when he suddenly remembered what it was about the three men in orange jumpsuits at the warehouse that had troubled him. Of course, why hadn't he seen it sooner? They had all been clean-shaven. The upper halves of their faces had been ruddy, as if they'd spent most of their waking hours outdoors. But the lower halves had been the color of sidewalk. One of the men had razor nicks on his skin, which suggested that they had only recently shaved off thick beards in order to make it more difficult to identify them as Muslims. Martin closed his eyes and summoned up an image of Talatbek Rabbani suspended from an overhead pipe while an assassin stabbed him in the neck. Trying to pick up Samat's trail, the Chechens, beardless in London, had come back to haunt the old one-legged Tajik warrior sooner than he'd imagined. 1994. The only fodder was cannon fodder.
"When we left off last week, Martin," Dr. Treffler was saying, "you were commenting on the fact,"
her eyes flicked down to the notes in her loose-leaf book,
"that you were able to do some things well the first time you try."
The company psychiatrist, wearing a tight skirt cut above the knee, uncrossed and recrossed her legs. As her thigh flashed into view, Martin turned his head away. He understood that everything she did had a purpose. The business with the legs was her way of harvesting information about his sex drive, assuming he had a sex drive. He wondered what another psychiatrist would make of Dr. Treffler's way of taking notes, filling the loose-leaf pages from top to bottom and edge to edge with a runty scrawl, the letters all leaning into some non-existent emotional blizzard. Solzhenitsyn had written Ivan Denisovich that way, but he'd been coming off 7 years in Stalin's gulag. What was her excuse? What did it mean when you didn't like margins?
"Yes, I remember now," he said finally, through the panes of the window and the green metal mesh, put there to keep clients from jumping. He could make out a bit of Maryland countryside, could see the last brown leaves clinging to the branches of trees. He felt an instinctive admiration for their tenacity. "It's always intrigued me," he continued, because she expected him to, because she sat there with her legs crossed and her thigh visible and her Mont Blanc fountain pen poised over the loose-leaf page. "It struck me as funny how some things you do them well the first time."
"Such as?" she inquired in a voice so toneless it betrayed absolutely no curiosity about the answer.
"Such as peeling a tangerine, such as cutting a fuse for plastic explosive long enough to give you time to get out of its killing range, such as pulling off a brush pass with a cutout in one of Beirut's crowded souks."
"What legend were you using in Beirut?"
"Dante Pippin." "Wasn't he the one?"
Bernice, they'd been on a first-name basis for the last several sessions, had flipped to another page in her loose-leaf book.
"Who was supposed to have been teaching history at a junior college? The one who wrote a book on the Civil War that he privately printed when he couldn't find a publisher willing to take it on?"
No, you're thinking of Lincoln Ditman with two T's and two N's. Pippin was the Irish dynamiter from Castletown Bear who started out as an explosives instructor on the farm. Later, posing as an IRA dynamiter, he infiltrated a Sicilian mafia family, the Taliban mullahs in Peshawar, a Hezbollah unit in the Bekaa Valley of Lebanon. It was this last mission that blew his cover. Dr. Treffler nodded as she added a note to the page.
I have a hard time keeping track of your various identities.
Me too. That's why I'm here. She looked up from the loose-leaf book.
Are you sure you have identified all of your operational biographies?
I've identified the ones I remember.
Do you have the feeling you might be repressing any?
Don't know. According to your theory, there's a good chance I'm repressing at least one of them.
The literature on the subject more or less agrees.
I thought you weren't convinced that I fit neatly into the literature on the subject. Dr. Treffler flashed one of her very rare smiles, which looked like a foreign object on her normally expressionless face.
You are hors genre, Martin, there's no doubt about it. Nobody in my profession has come across anyone quite like you. It will cause quite a stir when I publish my paper.
Changing the names to protect the innocent.
Changing the names to protect the guilty, too.
You're getting into the spirit of things, Bernice. The people who pay you for shrinking my head will be very pleased.
A psychiatrist doesn't shrink the patient's head, Martin. We shrink their problems.
I'm relieved to hear it.
Tell me more about Lincoln Ditman.
Such as?
Anything that comes to mind will do nicely.
When he still hesitated, she said,
Listen, Martin, you can tell me anything you can tell the director of the CIA.
Anything?
That's why you're in this room. This is a private clinic. The doctors who work here have been cleared to hear state secrets. We get to treat the agents who, for one reason or another, need help before returning to civilian life.
If you were the director and I was sitting like this facing you, our knees almost touching? Bernice nodded encouragement.
Go on.
I'd tell you that a camel is a horse designed by a committee. Then I'd tell you that the CIA is an intelligence agency designed by the same committee. And then I'd remind you that in every civilization known to man, the ratio of horses' asses to horses has been greater than one.
You're angry.
She jotted something on the loose-leaf page.
It's perfectly all right to be angry. Don't be afraid to let it out.
Martin shrugged. I thought I was just expressing some healthy cynicism.
Lincoln Ditman, she said, tugging the conversation back to her question.
He was raised in a small town in Pennsylvania named Jonestown. His mother was a Polish immigrant who had come to America after World War II. His father owned a chain of hardware stores with the main depot in Fredericksburg on the Virginia side of the Potomac. He wound up spending several months a year in Fredericksburg and took a son with him when the trips fell during school vacations. Lincoln used his free time to scour the battlefield for souvenirs. In those days, you could still find rusting bayonets or cannonballs or the barrels of muzzle-loading rifles in the fields after a torrential rain. By the time he reached his teens, when the other kids his age were reading Batman comics, Lincoln could recount every detail of the Battle of Fredericksburg. At Lincoln's urging, his father began buying Civil War paraphernalia from the farmers during his turn around the hardware stores. He returned home with rifles and bayonets and powder horns and Federal medals on the back seat of his Studebaker.
Not Confederate medals?
The Confederates didn't give medals to their soldiers. When Lincoln went off to college, he already had quite a collection. He even owned a rare English Whitworth, the weapon of choice for Confederate sharpshooters. The paper cartridges were damned expensive, but a skilled sniper could hit anything he could see.
Where did he go to college?
University of Pennsylvania. Majored in American history, wrote his senior thesis on the Battle of Fredericksburg. When he began teaching at the junior college, he turned it into a book.
That was the book he printed himself when he couldn't find a publisher?
It was a bitter disappointment to him, not finding a legitimate publisher.
What was it about Fredericksburg that was so special?
Martin's hand, clammy with perspiration, came up to massage his brow. The involuntary gesture wasn't lost on Dr. Treffler.
It was early in December of 1862, he began, staring vacantly out of the window at the horizon, watching for the flashes of the great battle being fought beyond it.
There was a new federal general in charge of the Army of the Potomac. His name was Burnside, Ambrose Burnside. He thought he saw a way to end the war with one swift assault across Virginia to capture the Confederate capital, Richmond. It was a brilliant plan. President Lincoln signed off on it, and Burnside force-marched his troops down the Potomac to a point across the river from Fredericksburg. If he could surprise the rebels and take the city, the road to Richmond would be open and the war would end almost before it got going.
Burnside had put in an urgent order for pontoon bridges, but when he reached Fredericksburg, he discovered that the War Department hadn't dispatched them. The Union Army wound up bivouacking for 10 days on its side of the river, waiting for the goddamned bridges, giving Robert Lee time to bring up his army and mass it on the heights above the city. When the bridges finally arrived and Burnside crossed the river, he found Bobby Lee and 75,000 Confederates blocking the road to Richmond. The weather was wintry. The autumnal mud in the rutted roads had turned hard. The Federals, advancing across sloping open ground, came on all day, wave after wave of them in their spanking bright factory-made uniforms. The rebels in homespun, dyed with plant pigments, fighting from below a low stone wall at the edge of a sunken road at the foot of Mary's Hill, beat back every attack. The sharpshooters, armed with Whitworths, picked off the Federal officers so easily that many of them began tearing off their insignias as they went into the line. Groups of Federals tried to take cover behind some brick houses on the plain, but the Yankee cavalry, using the flats of sabers, forced them back to the battle. Burnside kept track of the progress of the fighting from the roof of the Chatham mansion across the river. From a knob up on the heights, the mansion was within earshot, and Bobby Lee pointed it out to Stonewall Jackson. He told him that 30 years before, he'd courted the lady he wound up marrying at that very house. On a ridge line, a Confederate band belted out waltzes for the Southern gentlemen and ladies who had come down from Richmond to see the battle. Old Pete Longstreet, with a woman's woolen shawl draped over his shoulders, watched the fighting unfolding below him through a long glass fixed to a wooden tripod in front of the Confederate command post. It took a time to convince him that the Federal attack on the sunken road wasn't a feint. He couldn't swallow the idea that Burnside was squandering his life's blood in a frontal attack that had no chance of succeeding. At one point, an Irish brigade made it to within 15 paces of the sunken road, and even the rebels watching from the heights cheered their courage. But the 24th Georgians behind the low stone wall, firing and reloading and firing so steadily their teeth ached from biting off the paper cartridges, turned back that attack too. Burnside launched 14 assaults on the heights before darkness blotted out the killing fields. When the Federals finally retreated across the river the next day and counted noses, they discovered that 19,000 Union men had fallen at Fredericksburg. Martin sat humped over in the chair now, his lids squeezed shut, the flat of a hand pressed to his forehead, damming the migraine building up behind his eyes. When Lincoln Ditman went to Washington to research the book, he discovered Burnside's original order for the pontoon bridges in the Army archives. The word urgent had been inked out, probably by a Confederate sympathizer working at the War Department. You asked what was so special about Fredericksburg. Ditman concluded that if the pontoon bridges had been delivered on time, the war might have ended there in 1862 instead of dragging on until 1865. Martin, drained, went quiet. For some while, the only sound in the small airless room came from the whir of the tape recorder and the nib of Dr. Treffler's pen etching long lines of runty letters onto the loose-leaf page. When she finally looked up from her notebook, she asked, very softly, "How does Martin Odom know all this? The fact that the Confederates didn't give medals, the flats of sabers driving the Federals away from the shelter of brick houses, the Chatham Mansion, the band playing waltzes on Mary's Hill while Longstreet, with a shawl over his shoulders, watched the Georgians in homespun dyed with plant pigments fight off 14 attacks on the sunken road. It's almost as if you'd been there." Martin's mouth had gone dry, and the words that emerged from his lips rang tinny and hollow, the second half of an echo that had lost some of its shrillness on the way back. "Lincoln Ditman was there," he said. "He told me the details." Dr. Treffler leaned forward. "You heard Lincoln Ditman's voice describing the battle?" "Uh-huh." "Did he tell you that he'd been there during the battle? Did he tell you he'd seen the fighting with his own eyes?" "Not in so many words. But you being Martin Odom, you assumed he'd been an eyewitness at Fredericksburg." "He must have been there," Martin insisted plaintively. "How else could he have known all the things he knew? Lincoln told me lots more that isn't in any books." The words spilled out of Martin now. The night of the battle, temperatures plunged to below freezing. Even in the cold of winter, there were horseflies drawn to the blood oozing from wounds. The maimed Federals who were still alive dragged the dead into heaps and burrowed under the corpses to keep warm. Riderless horses pawed at the frozen ground looking for fodder, but the only fodder at Fredericksburg on 13 December 1862 was cannon fodder. Martin took a deep breath. That was the last line of Lincoln's book. The title came from the line. The book was called Cannon Fodder. Dr. Treffler waited for Martin's breathing to settle down before she spoke.
"Listen to me, Martin. Lincoln Ditman is your contemporary. He wasn't alive in 1862, which means he couldn't have been at the Battle of Fredericksburg."
Martin didn't respond. Dr. Treffler caught herself staring at him and turned away quickly, then laughed out loud and looked back.
"Wow, this is stunning. You heard Lincoln Ditman's voice at your first session. He gave you the lines of that Walt Whitman poem you recited."
"I remember. Silent cannons, soon to cease your silence, soon unlimbered to begin the red business. That wasn't the first time I heard Lincoln's voice. He's been whispering in my ear for years. By the way, it's Walter Whitman, not Walt. Lincoln told me he'd come across Whitman in a federal field hospital after Burnside retreated from Fredericksburg. The poet was worried sick about his brother who'd taken part in the battle and was looking everywhere for him. Lincoln recalled that the soldiers who knew Whitman called him Walter."
"Lincoln told you about Whitman being in the field hospital? About the soldiers calling him Walter?"
"Uh-huh."
"Did he recall it from having been there or from having read about it somewhere?"
Martin seemed not to want to deal with the question. Dr. Treffler decided Martin had had enough stress for one session.
"Your headache starting in again?" she asked.
"It's blinding me."
"What do you see when your eyes are shut tight like that?"
Martin thought about that. "A long blur of headlights, as if a camera has been set up on an overpass and the lens has been locked open to capture the streak of the cars speeding past underneath. Or the cosmos, yes, the entire cosmos in its Big Bang mode, expanding, inflating like a balloon with small black spots painted on it, and each spot on the balloon receding from every other spot."
"And how will this Big Bang end?"
"With me, marooned on one of the spots, alone in the universe."
1990. Lincoln Ditman takes on a life of his own. To the abiding satisfaction of its 8 sitting members, the Legend Committee had been upgraded from its windowless basement storage space at Langley to a 4th-floor conference room drenched in sunlight. That was the upside. The downside was that the new digs had an impregnable view of the vast outdoor parking lot used by the company plebeians. The patricians from the 7th floor, including Crystal Quest, the current deputy director of operations and the committee's immediate boss, all rated parking spaces in the underground garage, along with an elevator that whisked them to work without stopping at other floors along the way.
"Can't have everything," sighed the former station chief who chaired the Legend Committee the first time he set foot in the room the housekeepers were proposing and looked out one of the windows. He'd been hoping for Virginia countryside, not tarmac. To mask his disappointment, he came up with the aphorism that had been engraved over the door to the inner sanctum when he presided over Cairo Station oh so many years ago. "Yamasal, yambasal. One day honey, one day onions." "Where the heck are we?" he was asking Maggie Poole, who had specialized in medieval French history at Oxford and had never entirely lost her acquired British accent, an affectation particularly remarkable when she slipped French words into the conversation.
"We're on the 4th étage," she replied now, purposefully misunderstanding the question to get his goat.
"Up here, the water coolers are in the corridor outside the rooms, not inside."
"Oh, for Pete's sake, that's not what I meant, and you know it. You do that every occasion you can."
"Moi?" Maggie Poole blurted out innocently. "Certainly not."
"What he's asking," said the Yale-educated aversion therapist, "is what we are up to with the new legend for Dante Pippin."
Dante, sitting with his spine against a soft pillow to relieve the pressure on the shrapnel wound in his lower back, thought of these sessions as indoor sport. It was a painless way to pass an afternoon, even if his game leg and the back wound ached more or less round the clock. He closed his eyes to shield them from the bright sunlight slanting through the open Venetian blinds and relished the warmth on the skin of his face.
"I thought this time around," he offered, and he could almost hear the bones creaking as the ancient mariners of the Legend Committee craned their necks to stare at him, "we could begin in Pennsylvania."
"Why Pennsylvania?" demanded the lexicographer on loan from University of Chicago and happy to be. The per diem the company deposited in his bank account somehow never got reported to the Internal Revenue Service. The committee's doyen, a CIA veteran who began his professional career creating legends for the OSS agents during World War II and never let anyone forget it, fitted on a pair of perfectly round wire spectacles and flipped open the original Martin Odom 201 Central Registry folder.
Pennsylvania, he observed, straining to make out the small type on the biofile. Seems as good a place to start as any. Mr. Pippin's predecessor, Martin Odom, spent the first 8 years of his life in Pennsylvania, in a small town called Jonestown. His mother was a Polish immigrant. His father ran a small factory producing underwear for the U.S. Army. Jonestown was within driving distance of several Civil War battlefields, and Martin wound up going to a bunch of them while he was in grade school, Dante said from the sideline. His favorite, which he must have visited two or three times, was Fredericksburg.
Could visiting Fredericksburg make someone a Civil War expert?
Maggie Poole inquired eagerly. She had caught a glimpse of where they could be heading. Martin was a Fredericksburg expert for sure, Dante said with a laugh. His eyes were still tightly closed, and he was beginning, once again, to enjoy the business of legend building. It seemed to him the closest he'd ever come to novel writing. His stories about the battle there were so graphic, people who heard them sometimes jokingly wondered if he'd taken part in the Civil War.
Can you give us some examples? The chairman asked.
He would describe Bobby Lee up on Mary's Hill, inland from Fredericksburg, pointing out Burnside's command post in the Chatham Mansion across the Potomac to Stonewall Jackson, and recalling that he'd courted his wife under that roof 30 years before. Martin would describe old Pete Longstreet, his shoulders draped in a woman's woolen shawl, watching the battle unfolding below him through a long glass fixed to a wooden tripod, and telling everyone within earshot that the Federal attack on the sunken road had to be a feint, that the main attack would come somewhere else. The Legend Committee chairman peered at Dante over the rim of his wire eyeglasses. "Was Bobby Lee the general we know as Robert E. Lee?" he asked. "One and the same," Dante said from his place along the wall. "The Virginians called him Bobby Lee, though never to his face." "Well, this does open avenues for exploration," the chairman told the others. "Our man may not be a Civil War expert, but with a little help from his friends, he could certainly pass for one, couldn't he?"
"Which brings us to the name," Maggie Poole said. "And what could be more logique for Civil War expert than calling him Lincoln?"
"I suppose you were thinking of using Abraham as a first name," sneered the aversion therapist.
"Wat a verqueren Öff," Maggie Poole shot back.
She glared at the aversion therapist, clearly tempted to stick her tongue out at him.
"I was thinking along the lines of using Lincoln as a prénom because it would tend to give credibility to a Civil War legend."
"Lincoln something or other sounds quite elegant to me," Dante called from the wall.
"Merci, Mr. Pippin, for being so open-minded, which is more than I can say for some others in this room," ventured Maggie Poole.
"I once knew a gun collector in Chicago whose name was Dittman. That's with two T's and two N's," said the lexicographer. "There was some suggestion that Dittman wasn't his real name, but that's neither here nor there. He specialized in Civil War firearms. His pride and joy was an English sniper rifle. It was called the Wentworth or Whitworth, something like that. As I recall, the paper cartridges were exorbitant, but in the hands of a skilled sharpshooter, the rifle was considered to be a lethal weapon."
"Lincoln Dittman is a name with weight," the chairman decided. "How does it strike you, Mr. Pippin?"
"I could learn to live with it," he agreed. "And it would certainly be original to turn a field agent into a Civil War expert." The members of the Legend Committee knew they had hit pay dirt, and the ideas started to come thick and fast. He could start building the legend by visiting all the battlegrounds. "He ought to have a collection personnelle of Civil War firearms, I should think."
"I like having guns around," Pippin announced from his seat. "Come to think of it, a personal collection of Civil War weapons would make a great cover for an arms dealer, which is where Fred Astaire is heading with this legend."
"So we need to think in terms of a legend for an arms dealer?"
"Yes."
"Who in God's name is Fred Astaire?"
"It's Mrs. Quest's in-house nickname."
"Oh, dear."
"In what part of the world would Lincoln Dittman be operating? Who would be his clients?"
"Lincoln had to be careful not to give away family jewels. His clients would be a hodgepodge of people who are out to hurt America," he said.
"To step into Lincoln Dittman's shoes, you would have to do your homework."
"Do you mind reading up on a subject, Mr. Pippin?"
"Not at all. Sounds fun to me."
"He'd need professional credentials."
"Okay, let's summarize. He was raised in Jonestown, Pennsylvania, and visited Fredericksburg so often as a child that he knew the battlefield backward and forward at a time when his young friends were reading Batman comics."
"His father could have owned a chain of hardware stores with the Central Depot in Fredericksburg,
which meant he would have had to spend a lot of time there in any given year. Nothing would have been more natural than to have taken his young son with him whenever he could. Of course, he would have taken him along to Fredericksburg during school vacations. The young Lincoln Ditman would have joined the boys, scouring the battlefield for Civil War souvenirs that wash up to the surface after heavy rainfalls. At some point, Lincoln would have encouraged his father to hunt for rifles and powder horns and medals when he drove around. Oh, let's give him a Studebaker, which was a popular car after the war. Checking on his hardware stores. The local farmers keep these Civil War things in their attics, and Lincoln's father would have brought something back with him after each trip.
If I collected medals, Pippin noted, they'd all have to be from the Union Army. Confederate Army didn't award medals.
How did they get their soldiers to soldier if they didn't award medals?
They were fighting for a cause they believed in, Pippin said.
They were defending slavery, for God's sake.
Most of the Confederate soldiers didn't own slaves, Pippin said. Things that Martin had picked up during those visits to Fredericksburg so many years earlier were coming back to him.
They were fighting so the North wouldn't try and tell them what they could do and what they couldn't do.
Besides which, when the war started, Lincoln, I'm talking about Abraham, the president, didn't have the slightest intention of abolishing slavery and freeing the slaves. Nobody on either side of the Mason-Dixon line would have accepted this because nobody had any idea what to do with the millions of slaves in the Confederate States if they were freed.
Yankees didn't want emancipated slaves trekking north and stealing their manufacturing jobs for lower salaries. Southerners didn't want them homesteading Confederate land and growing cotton that could be marketed cheaper than plantation cotton, or even worse, voting in local elections. He really is something of a Civil War buff already.
Our Lincoln Ditman ought to have been a professor at one point, don't you think?
He could have taught Civil War history in some college, why not?
Problem, to teach in a college you need an advanced degree. Even if he reads up on the Civil War, he might not be able to convince a real Civil War expert that he earned a PhD in the subject.
Let him teach at a junior college, then. That way he wouldn't need an advanced degree, and what he knows about the Civil War could pass muster.
It would add to his credibility if he were to write a book on the subject.
Hang on, Pippin said. I don't think I have the stamina to write a book.
Takes more than stamina, I know, because I've written three. You need metal if you're going to refuse to be intimidated by all the options.
We could farm out the book. We could get it written for you and have a small university press that owes a favor publish it under your name. The Battle of Fredericksburg by Lincoln Ditman.
I've got the perfect title. Cannon Fodder, with a subtitle, The Battle of Fredericksburg.
Let's not get bogged down with the title, for goodness sake.
What do you think of all this, Mr. Pippin?
It's first-rate cover. Nobody would suspect an arms dealer who had been teaching Civil War history at a junior college of being CIA.
There's something missing from this legend.
What?
Yes, what?
Motivation is what's missing. Why has Lincoln Ditman sunk so low? Why is he associating with the scum of the earth, people who, by definition, are not friends of L'Amérique?
Good point, Maggie.
Because he's angry at America.
Why? Why is he angry at America?
He got into some sort of jam. He was humiliated.
Dante piped up from the sideline.
I don't mind being humiliated, but I'd appreciate it if sex weren't involved.
You people always think of sex when you want to put something into a biography that discredits the principal. Next thing you know, Lincoln Ditman will be a closet transvestite or something like that.
We take your point, Mr. Pippin.
What if the jam involved plagiarism?
He swiped the Heart of Cannon Fodder from a treatise published in the 20s or 30s that he found in the stacks of a library.
That would simplify matters for us. We wouldn't have to pay someone to write the book on Fredericksburg. We could find a treatise, there must be thousands of them lying around on shelves gathering dust, and copy it.
My luck, Dante groaned. I finally get to be the author of a book and it turns out I plagiarized it.
It's that or sexual deviation.
I'll take plagiarism.
A reviewer in an historical periodical, tipped off by an anonymous letter sent by us, could blow the whistle on Ditman, at which point he would lose his tenure and his job.
His professional reputation would be ruined.
Nobody else in the wide world of academia would touch him with a 10-foot pole.
Now we're getting somewhere. The colleges put pressure on you to publish or perish, and they expect you to hold down a full teaching load and do the research and writing in your free time.
The experience left Lincoln Ditman a bitter cynic. He wanted to get back at the college, at the system, at the country.
I'd say we're halfway home, gentlemen and ladies. The only thing that remains is to try all this out on our taskmaster, the DDO, Crystal Quest herself.
Dante Pippin reached for the cane propped against the wall and used it to push himself to his feet. Dull pain stabbed at his lower back and sore leg, but he was so elated he barely noticed it.
"I think Crystal Quest is going to be very satisfied with the Lincoln Ditman legend," he told the members of the legend committee.
"I know I am."
1991. Lincoln Ditman works the angles of the triangle.
"How did you get into the business of selling weapons?" the Egyptian wanted to know.
"Chances are you won't believe me if I tell you," Lincoln Ditman said.
"If he don't believe you," said the short American with the tooled cowboy boots and tapered Levi's and slicked back hair,
"you're in deep shit."
He spoke in a Texas drawl so silky that Lincoln had to strain to make out the words. The Egyptian and the Texan, strange bedfellows in this godforsaken Paraguayan frontier town across the border from Brazil, both laughed under their breaths, though there was no trace of mirth in their voices. Lincoln, sprawled on a sofa, his bad leg stretched straight out in front of him, the cane within arm's reach, his hands clasped behind his head, laughed with them.
"I was teaching Civil War history at a junior college," he said. "My area of expertise, I wrote a book on the subject once, was the Battle of Fredericksburg. Collecting Civil War weapons seemed like the natural thing to do. My pièce de résistance is a rare English Whitworth."
"But there's a sniper rifle, ain't it?" said the Texan.
Lincoln looked impressed. "Aren't many people around who can tell the difference between a Whitworth and an ordinary barnyard Enfield?"
"My daddy had one," the Texan said proudly. "Feds went and impounded it along with his other guns when he was nabbed for burning a nigger church to the ground in Alabama."
He tilted his head back and regarded Lincoln warily. The Texan, who had introduced himself as Leroy Streeter when he'd picked Lincoln up in front of the mosque with the gold-tinted roof on Palestine Street, across the border from Fosto Iguazu, said,
"Go and describe your Whitworth."
Lincoln smiled to himself. Back at Langley, they'd learned from the FBI that Leroy Streeter's father had once owned a Civil War Whitworth. They'd reckoned the son would be familiar with the weapon. If Leroy's quiz was what passed for checking bona fides in Triple Border, it certainly was amateur hour. An undercover agent wouldn't name drop, even the name of an antique rifle, if he couldn't backstop it up with details. Fact of the matter was that Lincoln did own a Whitworth. A collection of Civil War weapons went with the Ditman legend. He'd even fabricated cartridges and gone out to a remote landfill in New Jersey to see if the rifle was as accurate as its reputation held. It was. "Mr. Whitworth's rifle," he told Leroy now, "came factory equipped with a low-powered brass scope fixed atop the hexagonal barrel. Not many of the Whitworths around these days, even in museums, still have the scope. Mine also has the original brass tampon to plug the barrel against humidity and dust. The scope's fitted with little engraved wheels to sight the rifle and adjust for latitude and longitude errors." As he spoke, Lincoln kept his eyes on the Egyptian, who obviously ran the show here. He had not been introduced, though Lincoln had a good idea of his identity. The FBI's briefing book back in Washington had contained a blurry photo taken with a telephoto lens of an Egyptian known as Ibrahim bin Daoud, talking to a man identified as a Hezbollah agent in front of the entrance to the Maksud Plaza Hotel in Sao Paulo the previous year. The long, delicate nose and carefully trimmed gray beard visible in the photo were conspicuous on the Egyptian sitting on the sill across from him now. Stretched out on the unmade bed in the room above a bar in Ciudad del Este on the Paraguay side of Triple Border, the muddy heels of his boots digging into the mattress, Leroy was nodding emphatically at the Egyptian.
"He sure as hell's got hisself a Whitworth," he confirmed.
Lincoln was hoping that gun collecting would provide a useful bond between him and the Texan.
"Crying shame about your daddy's Whitworth," he said. "Bet the FBI goons didn't have the wildest idea what a goddamn prize they had in their hands when they confiscated it."
"They was too fucking dumb to tell the difference between fool's gold and actual gold," Leroy agreed.
Lincoln looked back at the Egyptian.
"To answer your question, from the Whitworth and my other guns, it was just a matter of branching out to Kalashnikovs and TOW anti-tank missiles, with the grenades and ammunition thrown in for good measure. Pays a lot better than teaching Civil War history at a junior college."
We are not in the market for Kalashnikovs and TOWs, the Egyptian noted coldly.
He's not interested in AK-47s and TOWs, the Texan explained. Now that Commie Rush has got one foot in the grave, you trip over this kind of hardware out here in Triple Border. He's interested in Semtex or ammonium nitrate, something in the neighborhood of 80,000 pounds of it, enough to fill one of those big moving vans. We pay cash on the barrelhead.
Lincoln locked his eyes on the Egyptian. He was a skeletal man with a round, pockmarked face and hunched shoulders, probably in his late 50s, though the gray beard could have been adding years to his appearance. The upper third of his face had disappeared behind dark glasses, which he wore despite being in a dingy room with the shades drawn.
Semtex in small quantities is no problem. Ammonium nitrate in any quantity is also no problem, he said. You probably know that ammonium nitrate is used as fertilizer. Mixed with diesel or fuel oil, it is highly explosive. The trick will be to buy a large amount without attracting attention, which is something I and my associates can organize. Where do you want to take delivery?
Leroy smiled out of one side of his mouth.
At a site to be specified on the New Jersey side of the Holland Tunnel.
Lincoln heard the cry of the muezzin. It wasn't a recording, but the real thing, summoning the faithful to midday prayer, which meant he'd been taken somewhere within earshot of the only mosque in Ciudad del Este, after Leroy had picked him up in front of the mosque in Foz do Iguazu. He'd been shoved into the back of a Mercedes and ordered to strap on the blackened-out ski goggles he found on the seat. "You taking me to the Saudi?" he'd asked Leroy as the Mercedes drove in circles for three-quarters of an hour to confuse him.
"I'm taking you to meet the Saudi's Egyptian," Leroy had answered. "If the Egyptian signs off on you, that's when you get to meet the Saudi, not before."
Lincoln had asked, "What happens if he doesn't sign off on me?" Leroy, sitting up front alongside the driver, had snorted.
"If and he don't sign off on you, he'll like us feed you to the pet crocodile he keeps in a swim pool."
Now Lincoln could feel Daoud scrutinizing him through his dark sunglasses.
"Where did you hurt your leg?" the Egyptian asked.
"Car accident in Zagreb," Lincoln said. "The Croats are crazy drivers."
"Where were you treated?"
Daoud was looking for details he could verify. Lincoln named a clinic in a suburb of Trieste. The Egyptian glanced at Leroy and shrugged. Something else occurred to him.
"What did you say the title of your book on Fredericksville was?"
Leroy corrected him. "It's Fredericksburg."
"I didn't say," Lincoln replied. "Title was the best part of the book. I called it Cannon Fodder."
Apparently Leroy was still fighting the War of Secession because he blurted out, "Cannon fodder is sure as hell what they was." His normal drawl, pitched a half octave higher, came across loud and clear.
"Federal cannon fodder, fighting to free the niggers and legitimate intermarriage and dictate the North's way of thinking on Southern gents."
The Egyptian repeated the title to make sure he'd gotten it right, then muttered something in Arabic to the fat boy piecing together the jigsaw puzzle on the linoleum-covered table in the alcove. The boy, who was wearing a shoulder holster with a plastic gun in it and chewing bubble gum that he inflated every time he fitted in a piece, sprang to his feet and rushed out of the room. The Egyptian followed him. Lincoln could hear their footfalls on the staircase of the ramshackled building as the boy headed downstairs, and Daoud climbed up one flight. He let himself into the room overhead and crossed it and dragged up a chair as a telephone sounded. Lincoln guessed that the Egyptian was phoning abroad to get his people to check out details of the Dittman legend. The DDO's people in Langley had anticipated this and laid in the plumbing. If someone nosed around the Trieste clinic, he would come across a record of a Lincoln Dittman being treated by a bone specialist for 3 days and paying his bill in cash the morning he was discharged. As for the book, Cannon Fodder had a paper trail. The Egyptian's contact would discover a 1990 reference to the publication of the book in Publishers Weekly. If he dug deeper, he would come up with 2 reviews, the first in a Virginia Junior College student newspaper praising one of the school's own teachers for his Civil War scholarship, the second in a Richmond, Virginia historical quarterly devoted to the War of Secession. The review of Cannon Fodder accused Lincoln Dittman of having plagiarized great chunks of a privately printed 1932 doctorate treatise on the Battle of Fredericksburg. There would be a small item in a Richmond newspaper repeating the plagiarism charge and reporting that a committee of the author's peers had examined the original treatise and Dittman's Cannon Fodder and discovered entire passages that matched. The article went on to say that Lincoln Dittman had been fired from his post teaching history at a local junior college.
Chain bookstores would have reported modest sales before the book was withdrawn from circulation. If anyone hunted hard enough, copies of the first and only edition, what was left of the original 500-book print run, could be found in the Strand in Manhattan and several other second-hand bookstores across the country. On the inside of the book jacket there would be a photograph of Dittman with a Schimmelpenninck jutting from his lips, along with a brief biography. Born and raised in Pennsylvania, a Civil War buff from the time he started visiting battlefields as a youngster, an expert on the Battle of Fredericksburg, currently teaching Civil War history at a Virginia junior college. Waiting for the Egyptian to return, Lincoln plucked a Schimmelpenninck from the metal tin in his jacket pocket and held the flame of the Zippo lighter to the end of it. He inhaled deeply and let the smoke gush through his nostrils. "Mind if I smoke?" he inquired politely.
"Smokin'," Leroy remarked. "Poisons the lungs. You ought to give it up."
"Trouble is," Lincoln said, "to give up smoking you need to become someone else. Tried that once, went cold turkey for a while, but it didn't work out in the end." After a while, the Egyptian returned to the room and settled into the wooden chair set catty-corner to the sofa.
"Tell me more about what you did in Croatia," he instructed Lincoln.
Croatia had been Crystal Quest's brainchild. For all her imperiousness, she was old school. She believed a good legend needed more than a paper trail to give it authenticity. "If he's supposed to be an arms merchant," she'd argued when she dragged Lincoln up to the seventh floor at Langley to get the director to sign off on the operation, "there's got to be a trail of genuine transactions that the opposition can verify."
"You're proposing to actually set him up in the arms business?"
"Yes, sir, I am."
"Whom would he sell to?" the director had demanded, clearly unsettled by the notion of one of the company's agents establishing his bona fides by becoming a bona fide arms merchant.
"He'll buy from the Soviets who are running garage sales from their arsenals in East Germany and deliver to the Bosnians. Since U.S. policy tilts toward the Bosnians, our congressional oversight commissars won't give us a hard time if they get wind of it, which they won't if we're careful. The idea behind this is to put Lincoln in the path of one Sami Akbar, an Azerbaijani who buys arms for an Al-Qaeda cell in Bosnia."
"As usual, you've covered all the bases, Fred," the director had noted with a flagrant lack of enthusiasm.
"Sir, that's what you pay me for," she'd shot back. Lincoln had spent the next 4 months tooling around the Dalmatian coast in a serviceable Buick, avoiding the Serb undercover agents like the plague, using a fax to contact a shadowy Frankfurt entity and purchase truckloads of the Soviet surplus arms being sold off by Russian soldiers, soon to be recalled to the USSR from East Germany, meeting the drivers at night on remote back roads as they came across Slovenia, then arranging for delivery at crossing points on the Dalmatian coast between Croatia and Bosnia. It was at one of these pre-dawn meetings that Lincoln first felt the fish nibbling at the bait.
"Could you get your hands on explosives?" a Muslim dealer who went by the name of Sami Akbar had casually asked as he took possession of a two-truck convoy loaded with TOW anti-tank missiles and mortars, and handed Lincoln a satchel filled with crisp $100 bills bound in wrappers from a Swiss bank. Lincoln had dealt with Sami 5 times in the past 4 months.
"What do you have in mind?" he had inquired.
"I have a Saudi friend who is shopping around for Semtex or ammonium nitrate."
"In what quantities?"
"Very large quantities."
"Your friend looking to celebrate the end of Ramadan with a big bang?"
"Something like that."
"Russians aren't peddling Semtex or ammonium nitrate. It would have to come from the States."
"Are you saying it is within the realm of possibility?"
"Everything is within the realm of possibility, Sammy, but it will cost a pretty penny."
"Money is not a problem for my Saudi friend. Thanks to Allah and his late father, he is very rich."
The Muslim had produced a scrap of paper from a shirt pocket and, pressing it to the fender of the truck, had printed out with the stub of a pencil the name of a town and the street address of a mosque, along with a date and an hour. Lincoln had crouched in front of the Buick parking lights to read it.
"Where in hell is Foz do Iguaçu?" he'd asked, though he knew the answer.
"It is in Brazil, right across the frontier from Paraguay, at a place called Triple Border, where Brazil and Paraguay and Argentina meet."
"Why can't we get together somewhere in Europe?"
"If you are not interested, only say so. I will find someone else who is."
"Hey, don't get me wrong, Sami. I'm interested. I'm just worried that it's a long way to go for nothing." Sami had coughed up a laugh.
"You guys who deal arms tickle me. I do not call 250,000 U.S. nothing."
Lincoln had glanced again at the scrap of paper.
"Are you sure your rich Saudi friend will contact me if I am standing outside the mosque on Palestine Street at 10 in the morning 10 days from today?"
Sami had nodded into the darkness.
"The person will contact you and take you to him."
In the small room over the bar, the Egyptian listened in silence to Lincoln's account of his dealings in Croatia. In the alcove, the boy, working again at his jigsaw puzzle, blew bubbles with the gum until they burst against his fleshy lips. Leroy cleaned the fingernails of his left hand with a fingernail of his right hand. When Lincoln reached the end of the story, the Egyptian, lips pursed, sat without moving a muscle, weighing his next move. Finally, he announced,
"Leroy will take you back to your hotel in Fostu Iguazu. Wait there until you hear from me."
"How long will that take?" Lincoln asked. "Every day I'm away from the Balkans costs me money." The Egyptian shrugged.
"If you become bored, you are free to yawn."
"How did it go?" Lincoln asked Leroy when the two were alone in the car and heading toward the bridge and Fostu Iguazu. "The fact that you're still alive can only mean it went well." Martin glanced at the Texan, whose face flashed in and out of the light as cars passed in the opposite direction.
"You're serious, aren't you?"
"Fucking A, I'm serious."
"Get it into your skull," he said, drumming a forefinger against his own. "You're associating with tough customers down here."
Lincoln had to swallow a smile. Felix Kick had used much the same words as he wound up the briefing back in Washington.
"Holy mackerel, watch your ass when you get to Triple Border," he'd said. "You'll be rubbing shoulders with mighty ornery folks."
The briefing in Washington had taken place on neutral turf, a nondescript foggy-bottom conference room that had been swept by company housekeepers and then staked out until the principals showed up at the crack of noon. From word one, the tension had been as thick as the fog Lincoln had braved driving to work that morning from the safe house in Virginia. It wasn't so much the FBI briefer, a short, stumpy veteran counter-terrorism maven named Felix Kick, with the low center of gravity of an NFL lineman. The CIA had dealt with him on any number of occasions, most especially when he directed the FBI's counter-terrorism team at the American Embassy in Moscow, and considered him to be a straight shooter. The tension could be traced to the clash of cultures, to the mistrust J. Edgar Hoover, who had run the FBI with an iron hand until his death in 1972, had sown into the agency's bureaucratic fabric during his 48 years at the helm. The fact that the FBI, acting in obedience to a formal presidential finding, was being obliged to pass on to its arch-competitor at Langley an operation and the assets that went with it, or what was left of them, only made matters worse. Kick put the best possible face on the situation in his opening remarks. "Triple Border," he told Lincoln as Crystal Quest and several other Wallas looked on, "which is the nickname for the zone where Brazil, Paraguay, and Argentina meet up, is a cesspool filled with scum from Hamas, Hezbollah, Egypt's Islamic Brotherhood, the Irish Republican Army, the Basque separatist group ETA, Colombia's FARC, all of them operating under false identities or false flags. The FBI's interest in Triple Border goes back roughly 10 years, when a large expatriate population fleeing the civil war in Lebanon gravitated into the area. The local authorities, some of them bribed, some of them intimidated, turned their backs on the sharp rise in crime in their backyard. You could buy and sell almost anything down there. Passports for $2,000 a clip, including the mugshot and the official government stamp. Stolen cars, cheap electronics, along with the staples on any lawless frontier these days, drugs and arms. Several terrorist organizations set up guerrilla training camps in the Mato Grosso, the outback, to teach recruits how to rig car bombs or shoot the Soviet hardware that anyone could purchase in the back alleys of the border towns using money conveniently laundered by the banks at Triple Border."
"Sounds like your people have a handle on the problems," Lincoln said. "Why are you backing off?"
"They're backing off," Crystal Quest said, "because the director has convinced the White House that American interests would be better served if the CIA held the Triple Border action." Quest fingered some crushed ice out of a bowl and began munching on it. "Drugs, contraband cars, a black market in computer software, or pirated Hollywood films are small potatoes. We have reason to believe the Triple Border has become a staging area for Muslim fundamentalist groups working in the Western Hemisphere. At Triple Border, they can purchase all the arms their hearts desire and launder the money to pay for it.
and their fedayeen can get some R&R at the local bars, out of sight of the mullahs who expect them to remain chaste and pray five times a day. The mosques in Foz do Iguaçu on the Brazilian side and Ciudad del Este on the Paraguayan side are filled with Sunnis and Shiites who in other parts of the Muslim world don't give each other the time of day. In Triple Border, we suspect that they're plotting to attack the United States and kill Americans.
Kick spoke up. Despite what the CIA thinks of our collective abilities, the FBI did manage to run a handful of assets in Triple Border. With some persistence, one of them struck pay dirt, pay dirt being the Egyptian named Ibrahim bin Daoud, who runs the fundamentalist training camp called Boa Vista. Daoud, whose real name is Khalil al-Jabarin, has a record. Al-Jabarin was convicted of being a spiritual leader of the Muslim Brotherhood and served serious time in a Cairo military prison. He has the physical and mental scars to show for it. Electrodes attached to testicles are said to be the torture of choice of Egyptian jailers. No doubt about it, Daoud himself is a cold-blooded killer. Whether it's the result of his suffering or his genes, we don't know. What we do know is that last month he snuck a crocodile into a swimming pool in Sao Paulo and then pushed in a man accused of being a police informer, while some local hookers holding paper plates filled with defrosted hors d'oeuvres looked on. Money was spread around and the murder was hushed up. We know the story's not apocryphal because one of the hookers was a collateral asset. The dead informer was our principal asset in Triple Border.
So the FBI has gone blind out there? Lincoln asked.
For all intents and purposes, yes.
The principal asset who got close to Daoud didn't have an understudy?
We didn't get around to it in time, Kick admitted.
What else can I expect to find at Triple Border besides ravenous crocodiles?
Kick, Lincoln had a nodding acquaintance with him from having sat in on several of the rare joint CIA-FBI coordinating sessions, slid an FBI briefing book across the conference table.
What we've picked up is all in here, he said. You're likely to come across a Texan who goes by the name Leroy Streeter. He's what we call a crossover. In this case, an Aryan nationalist nut who is making common cause with the Muslim fundamentalists. Mind you, the mix is potentially lethal. If and when Muslim terrorists do attack the United States, the white supremacists could provide infrastructure support and eventually hit men, since it's easier for an American to gain entrance to public places than an Arab from the Middle East. Leroy Streeter may or may not be the Texan's real name, by the way. The guy you'll meet, he's 5'2", 130 pounds, speaks with a Texan drawl, travels under a passport made out to a Leroy Streeter Jr. Leroy Streeter Sr. was the Führer of a Texas-based white supremacist splinter group called the Nationalist Congress. He died of cancer in Huntsville while he was serving time for blowing up a black church in Birmingham. State Department consulate in Mexico City issued a passport to a Leroy Streeter Jr. 4 years ago, but Argentina's Secretariat for State Intelligence thinks that he drowned on a Rio beach 2 years back. As far as we know, no body was recovered, which means that Leroy Streeter Jr. has risen from the dead or someone is using his passport. Either way, he's high on the FBI's most wanted list.
Don't let yourself get sidetracked, Crystal Quest told Lincoln. Leroy Streeter is not the target of this operation. The person we're after down there is the Saudi.
Does the Saudi have a name? Lincoln inquired.
Everyone has a name, Quest snapped. FBI just doesn't know it.
From what our principal asset was able to tell us before his untimely death, continued Kick, unfazed by Quest's dig at the bureau, we understand the Saudi is the kingpin of a fundamentalist group that recently surfaced as a blip on our radar screen. It's been operating out of Afghanistan since the Russians were evicted from the country 2 years ago and calls itself Al-Qaeda, which means the base. The Saudi appears to be organizing Al-Qaeda cells across Europe and Asia and running them from the Sudanese capital of Khartoum.
How do I get to this Saudi?
With any luck, he gets to you, Quest said. He's in the market for explosives, lots of it. The FBI asset picked up rumors that the Saudi is shopping around for a truckload and is offering a small fortune if it can be delivered to an address in the United States. The explosives may be the tip of the iceberg. The Saudi may have his heart set on acquiring something that will render the explosives more lethal.
You're talking about a dirty bomb, Lincoln guessed.
He's talking about gift-wrapping the explosives with plutonium or enriched uranium radioactive waste, Quest said, which would result in the contamination of a wide area when the charge is detonated. Hundreds of thousands could be affected.
It's because of this threat that the president decided to bring the CIA into the picture.
Kick said, Mind you, Lincoln, I understand that's the name you're using now. The business about a dirty bomb is a worst-case scenario and pure speculation.
End of Disc 5. Please continue with the next disc.